Welcome to the final lecture in the Trotskyism series. Richard, take it away.
Okay. As I approached this, the final installment of the Trotsky lectures, I found myself wondering about the experience and wanting to sum it up. Overall, I've not been very satisfied. Much of the time, I felt like someone giving a visitor to the city a quick tour of the Metropolitan Museum. Does one attempt an historically responsible overview or just point out one's personal favors? If one opts for the latter approach, is there not a great danger that a personal response, an expression of what this means to you, may leave the visitor bewildered? Just as an excessive expression of the appropriate art historical knowledge leaves one buried under a mountain of facts. I have, I realize, just now used an especially problematic metaphor. I've analogized the history of Trotskyism to a museum. But undoubtedly, for almost all of you, this is probably exactly what it seems. It is a visit to a place where one goes to admire and contemplate the products of once living cultures of the left. Some of this may be beautiful and inspiring, but it is no longer alive. It has what Lionel Trilling called the sense of the past attached to it. But this metaphor was not my intent, or at least not my main intent. Rather, my main intent had been not to give a tour of the Trotskyism Museum with some eccentric personal comments, but rather to prompt the question about platypus. For the centrality of Trotskyism to platypus lies in the question no longer of what is to be done, but what can be done. If one can no longer be political in the sense that Trotsky was political, and that his disciples believed that they could continue, then what remains of the Marxist project? I have repeatedly emphasized the challenge that Trotskyism poses to platypus. Excuse me. In a previous lecture, I suggested that if the Trotskyist response to the regression of the 20th century seems quixotic, then platypus seems Minardian. We are both identical in one sense and radically different in meaning in another. This is the aspect of the lectures that has most frustrated me. What ought to be in the foreground, namely the political stakes, is what remains most obscure. Trotskyism was and remains a political project. The relationship between this political project, which I admit seems to me exhausted, and platypus, a pre-political project as we describe it, a project that as yet only aspires towards politics, is difficult to draw out. So I find myself endlessly gesturing. Part of the problem is that the way Trotskyism and platypus talk about themselves is so radically different. Immediately, one is struck by the difference of style. Trotskyism is exhortatory. It shouts at history. You are not over. Platypus is oblique, sometimes oracular. It seems to whisper mysterious hints. Trotskyism speaks of its continuity with the past. Platypus pretends that there is a blank slate. Each is a myth. The myth of continuity allows Trotskyism to cover its own necessary innovations. For us, the myth of radical newness allows us not to be overwhelmed by the burden of past failure. If I aver that I think of platypus as a post-Trotskyist in some fundamental sense, what do I mean by that? That platypus is a continuation of a tradition that has become a byword for sectarian irrelevance? Or is it rather that platypus makes no sense without Trotskyism? That all of our formulations about the death of the left are actually historically contingent on the exhaustion of Trotskyism. That Trotskyism cannot be seen by platypus as merely an attempt to keep Marxism alive, but rather the central attempt in the 20th century. Hence my anxiety that admitting the failure of Trotskyism is an admission of the failure of Marxism. This anxiety is not necessarily shared by others in platypus. It is perhaps not something one can argue for, but rather an intuition. I do not think that there was a better form of Marxism developed to cope with the problems of the 20th century. There are other Marxist traditions, above all the Frankfurt School, that supplemented, perhaps vitally supplemented, but nothing that can replace it. If Trotskyism has been inadequate, I think that it raises fundamental questions about Marxism. This final lecture nominally traces the history of Trotskyism from 1953 to 1963. These dates were chosen based on the beginning and the end of the split in the Fourth International. The first date, however, also coincides with the death of Stalin, Trotsky's great antagonist and the victor of the inter-party struggles of the 1920s. The death of Stalin would have a paradoxical effect on Trotskyism. On the one hand, it led to a process of de-Stalinization in the Soviet Union, and even more importantly, the Western Communist parties, which gradually removed the anathema against Trotsky, the impossible subject, as Krasso called it. And that was obviously good for Trotskyists. But like the expansion of Stalinism as a result of World War II, it also led to confusion and a lack of focus. A great deal of the moral and political energy of Trotskyism came from the belief that it uniquely represented a tradition that was revolutionary but anti-Stalinist. De-Stalinization, while it cleared away a certain hysterical anti-Trotskyism on the left, also left the left more ambivalent about its meaning. At the beginning of this period in 1953, Stalinism still seemed like a frightening monolith, and the man at the top of this apparatus of global Stalinism was still worshipped by millions as a genius and the successor to Lenin. The next decade after Stalin's death saw Stalinism survive, but it became something more banal. After the Khrushchev revelations in 1956, Stalinists themselves became confused. By 1963, the end of this period, the left had become more open than in 1953 or 1933, but it also became more diffuse in its response to ideological questions. Even what the questions were was no longer as clear as it would have been 10, 20, or 30 years earlier. The scope of the left had shifted. Its focus was no longer primarily European. And it is this period that sees decolonization and the birth of the Third World. Issues like sexuality and gender would take the stage a bit later. And Philip Larkin has a beautiful poem, which I'm actually going to read, because it gives a sense of the moment, about 1963. Sexual intercourse began in 1963, which was rather late for me, between the end of the Chatterley Band and the Beatles' first LP. Up to then, there'd only been a sort of bargaining, a wrangle for the ring, a shame that started at 16 and spread to everything. Then all at once, the quarrel sank, everyone felt the same, and every life became a brilliant breaking of the bank, a quite unlosable game. So life was never better than in 1963, though just too late for me, between the end of the Chatterley Band and the Beatles' first LP. But to go back now from sexual freedom and poetry, which are the aims of Marxism, back to politics, which are its means, though I think that for many people in 1963 on the non-Stalinist left, that sense that life was beginning to be beautiful was a, particularly people who were young then, was a common sense. So going back to this Third World point, since in our time the category Third World is overlaid with racial and economic aspects, it has to be pointed out that in its origins, the idea of the Third World bears a striking resemblance to the idea of the third camp of people like Shakhtin. In other words, it's the first world of the West, the second world of the Soviet Union, and the third world like the third camp of the... But whereas Shakhtin et al. Were still obsessed by the problem of the Soviet Union, the logic of third worldism, as opposed to third campism, was to move away from the centrality of the Soviet Union. The Russian question, as the Spartans still charmingly called it in the late 1980s, no longer mattered. In college, in the late 1980s, I would meet people who did not know what they thought about the Soviet Union and did not really care because the Russians were white people who lived in a gray, dull world. What really mattered to them was Cuba and South Africa and Palestine. If the Russians helped those struggles, that might be good, but there was nothing much to learn or think about the Russian experience. Of course, in its prejudices, such attitudes were unconscious Stalinism. But to have called it Stalinism would have puzzled the people who held those attitudes. Furthermore, similar political positions could be arrived at by people who came originally even from a Trotskyist tradition. The ISO, for example, comes from a third campus tradition and is now definitely third worldist. But now I would like to briefly recapitulate the trajectory of Trotskyism that we've been tracing. In the previous lectures, we've traced three stages in the evolution of Trotskyism. In the first phase, after Lenin's incapacitation and death, Trotskyism sees itself not as Trotskyism, but as the struggle to continue genuine Leninism in the Communist International. It is the left opposition which understands the Comintern as turning to the right with the recession of revolutionary possibilities in the West and the isolation of the Soviet Union. First against the troika of Stalin, Zinoviev, and Kamenev, and then later allied with Zinoviev and Kamenev, who, however, proved vacillating allies, who eventually capitulated to Stalin, Trotsky, first in the Soviet Union and then in exile, proved to be the most politically and intellectually consistent opponent of Stalin and Stalinism from within the communist movement. Finally, after the catastrophe of Hitler's victory, Trotsky declared the Comintern bankrupt and set out to build a new Fourth International to replace the failed Second and Third Internationals. Trotsky himself saw this new phase as a continuation of the previous one, just one unfortunately fought on more difficult terrain. Here, some suspicions of the master himself arise. In effect, Trotskyism, the Fourth International, had now become a new stream of Marxism alongside social democracy and Stalinized communism. One could perhaps, in other words, fourth next to second and third, one could perhaps insist on seeing this as a political continuum with Trotskyism on the left, Stalinism in the center, and social democracy on the right. But it is not so simple. Rather, the situation is more like a triangle. On any given issue, any two of these may be more similar to each other than the third. If the issue is supporting the Allies in the war against fascism, then social democracy and Stalinism line up against Trotskyism because both are anti-fascist. If the issue is denouncing the cult of Stalin and calling for workers' democracy in the USSR, then social democracy and Trotskyism align because they are both anti-Stalinist. But at other times, Trotsky would feel compelled to defend the Soviet Union, and here Trotskyists would often seem closer to Stalinism than social democracy. And this brings us to the third period in the evolution we have discussed, the complex triangular relationship of Trotskyism to socialism, to social democracy and Stalinism, its siblings from the breakup of Second International Marxism, which will create instability in Trotsky. So I have some diagrams here. We don't know if you can see them.
Pretty much, yeah.
Can people see them? Okay, so this is the situation in the 1920s. This is the way Trotsky sees it. Trotsky is on the left, Stalin in the center, Bukharin on the right. Zinoviev and Kamenev, at times allied with Stalin, then with Trotsky, then capitulating with Stalin, are in between Trotsky and Stalin. So it's a left-right continuum with Trotsky on the left. There also would have been people who would have perhaps seen themselves as to the left of Trotsky, one time the left opposition, but by the mid-late 20s they disappear. This is Trotskyism as it sees the world in the 30s. Here you have social democracy and Stalinism, and here you have Trotskyism, and there's a relationship between all three. Now, social democracy and Stalinism are lumped under reference. Trotskyism is revolution, but it's not a simple sort of left-right. It's more complicated. And if you wanted a diagram of sort of the evolution, you would have First International here, which splits off into anarchism, and then you have Marxism, meaning Second International, and then that breaks off into the continuation, social democracy. And then you have the Third International, which then you have Trotskyism over here versus Stalin. So this is the historical development of these things, all these historical branches. You have the complex triangular relationship of Trotskyism to social democracy and Stalinism, its sibling, so to speak, from the breakup of Second International Marxism after 1914, will create instability within Trotskyism after the period of the 40s. This begins already during Trotsky's lifetime in 1939, but greatly accelerates after his death, especially in the post-war period. The disintegration of Trotskyism tends in either the direction of a capitulation to social democracy, Stalinophobia, so you could pull Stalinism, or social democracy rather, or Stalinism, Stalinophilia. So Shachtman's evolution represents the former tendency, Pabloism the latter tendency. This problem of Trotskyism in mid-century is by no means a simple one, and there is no clearly correct approach. In fact, many an ex-Trotskyist in despair over politics in the mid-century might feel that, to quote Yeats, things fall apart, the center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Yeats actually wrote that at the end of the First World War. But there was a reaction, one might say, against the passionate intensity of the 60s, a temptation perhaps too glibly criticized by the new left of those who had been political in the 30s and then became suspicious of the passionate intensity of the 30s, which would once again return to fashion with the 60s. And incidentally, I'd like to correct here a misimpression. In the discussion afterwards in Chicago, the last session, and by the way, you should all be listening to the recordings of the discussions in Chicago. They're excellent, and they're a vital addition to these lectures. You get much more out of them if you listen. During a presentation on Mandel's Why the Soviet Union is Not State Capitalist, which was described as an apologia for the bureaucracy, Chris suggested that I might have a Mandelite perspective here, and that this might be a point of difference between us. Once again, I wish to make clear that my objection to state capitalism is that it's intellectually dishonest. Although Mandel would at times certainly lean in a Stalinophilic direction, the issue here is not one of politics, but analysis, and I do think that politics and analysis can and should be separated. And here I think Mandel's analysis is basically the same as that of the Sparks and Trotsky. And to the extent that Trotskyists have tended to substitute loyalty to politics and program for analysis, this has, in my view, contributed to hollowing out of Marxism. It was not a good thing, for example, that Cannon took the right position but ended up denying reality. So what I'm not defending is a Mandelite perspective. In fact, I'm not so much saying that Mandel is correct on anything other than the negative point about the Soviet Union not being capitalist. And there are undoubtedly differences between Chris and me, but as I said, I don't think they're describable in terms like Mandelite, however, because what I'm not putting forward is so much a positive position, but a negative position. And we could discuss what I think those differences between Chris and me are in terms of the perspective of this course afterward. Now, the description of this period in the Spartacist pamphlet on the genesis of Pabloism is excellent, and I wish only to point out a few highlights. So I'm going to read a few excerpts. First excerpt. The later Pabloist capitulation to Stalinism was prepared by impressionistic overstatement of its opposite, Stalinophobia. In November 1947, Pablo's international secretariat wrote that the Soviet Union had become a worker state degenerated to the point where all progressive manifestations of the remains of the October conquest are more and more neutralized by the disastrous effects of the Stalinist dictatorship. What remains of the conquest of October is more and more losing its historic value as a premise for socialist development. From the Russian occupation forces or from pro-Stalinist governments, which are completely reactionary, we do not demand the expropriation of the bourgeoisie. Again, I mean, the interesting thing is the oscillation because of the confusion from Stalinophobia to Stalinism. So people could often switch which parts of this instability of the triangle they lean to, and the people who resisted, so to speak, both, sometimes were also resisting reality. So it's just a very complicated problem. And then the Sparks point out, within the SWP, the rumor circulated that Cannon himself, the epitome of orthodoxy, was flirting with the characterization that the Soviet Union had become a totally degenerated worker state, i.e. a state capitalist regime, a position which Natalia Trotsky shortly embraced. On the question of Stalinist expansion into Eastern Europe, the Fourth International was united in simple-minded orthodoxy. An extensive discussion of the Kremlin in Eastern Europe, Fourth International, November 1946, by E.R. Frank, Bert Cochran, who later the Cochranites became one of the most, basically formed the Stalinophilic tendency in the Social Workers' Party, was shrill in its anti-Stalinist tone, again, an oscillation from one side to the other, and tended towards the view that the countries occupied by the Red Army would be deliberately maintained as capitalist states, which, by the way, is exactly the position one would have concluded from an orthodox understanding of A polemic against Shachtman by Germain, that meaning Mandel, dated 15th of November 1946, was still more categorical. The theory of a degenerated worker state being installed in a country where there has not yet previously been a proletarian revolution is dismissed simply as absurd. And Germain rhetorically queries, does Shachtman really think that the Stalinist bureaucracy has succeeded in overthrowing capitalism in half our continent? Fourth International, February 1947. The Spartacists comment quite correctly. The methodology here is the same as that pursued more cynically by the International Committee in later years over the question of Cuba. Perplex, then deny reality. With the difference that the class character of Eastern Europe, with capitalist economic institutions, but the state power held by the occupying army of the degenerated worker state, was far more difficult to understand. Empiricists and renegades, I love that phrase, of course, had no difficulty in characterizing the Eastern European states. And here they're quoting the Shachtmanites. Everyone knows that the countries where the Stalinists have taken power, they have proceeded at one or another rate to establish exactly the same economic, political, social regime as exists in Russia. Everyone knows that the bourgeoisie has been or is rapidly being expropriated, deprived of all its economic power, and in many cases deprived of mortal existence. Everyone knows what remnants of capitalism remain in those countries will not even be remnants tomorrow, that the whole tendency is to establish a social system identical with that of Stalinist Russia. And go on and just read one more passage. I'm assuming that you've all read this so we can discuss it, but I want to highlight these passages because I think they get at the key of the problem. The post-war stabilization of European capitalism, the emergence of the Stalinist parties as the dominant reformist workers' parties in Europe, the expansion of Stalinism in Eastern Europe, apparently flying in the face of Trotsky's analysis that Stalinism could only betray, the destruction of capitalism by peasant-based nationalist Stalinist formations in Yugoslavia. All these developments pose new theoretical problems for the Trotskyist movement, which the SWP stripped of a layer of talented intellectuals by the petty bourgeois Shachtman split. It's an interesting juxtaposition. The talented intellectuals were the petty bourgeois empiricist renegades. And shortly thereafter, deprived of Trotsky's guidance, could not handle. The SWP's immediate response was to retreat into a sterile orthodoxy stripped of real theoretical content, thus rendering its isolation more complete. And as was previously discussed, in other lectures, the real question that is avoided here in an otherwise spot-on analysis, a very good piece, is why empiricists and renegades, they are necessarily petty bourgeois, of course, since the working class apparently never generates empiricists and renegades, could so clearly perceive reality, but orthodox upstanding Trotskyists had to retreat into a sterile orthodoxy. Was this merely an unfortunate temporary problem, or did the divergence of reality from Trotsky's predictions show a deeper theoretical limitation of Trotskyism? In particular, what did it mean that a degenerated worker state could be installed in a country where there had not yet previously been a proletarian revolution, when theory inclined Trotskyists to dismiss this as, quote, absurd, unquote, the earlier Ernest Mandel of 1947, not 1951. This is not an abstruse theoretical question, but one that goes straight to the heart of the Trotskyist imagination of Stalinism as, quote, Thermidor, unquote. Now, we have in this lecture, however, entered a fourth phase of Trotskyism. So Trotskyism originated first in the 20s as the left opposition, a response to the rise of Stalinism, and then after 1933, in effect, became a third current on the Marxist left, next to Stalinism and social democracy, hence my diagram. With the apparent eclipse of anarchism, these three possibilities seem to define the left. I mean, anarchism played a role in the Spanish Civil War, but other than that, it didn't seem a viable option for most people in places like the United States or Western Europe. And the problem for Trotskyism was fundamentally to stake out a position vis-a-vis the other two. Now, on the whole, the theoretical position with regard to social democracy was the easier, since the Trotskyist criticism of social democracy was merely the continuation of the Third International's criticism. The harder position to establish was the one vis-a-vis Stalinism, and here the Trotskyist movement fractured along the lines of tension of Trotsky's own thought. It is true that orthodoxy tended to emphasize the reformist character of Stalinism, making it similar to social democracy. Against this, Trotskyism could see itself as the form that revolutionary Marxism took in the mid-20th century, in my other diagram, a struggling but proud remnant that would one day revive the entire tradition. But the underlying problem with this orthodoxy was that if Stalinism was reformism, then it was a reformism sui generis. Although in many places, Stalinist parties did indeed play an obvious reformist role. So the two biggest communist parties in Western Europe, France and Italy, are good examples. They played the same sort of role that a left social democratic party would play. It nevertheless was hard to see Stalinism as a global phenomenon, as reformism. How could one see Mao as a reformist? In practice, therefore, the role of Trotskyism on the left was a dual protest, a protest against totalitarianism of Stalinism on the one hand and reformism of social democracy on the other. The specific ideological contents of this dual protest varied greatly among the various Trotskyisms, but they shared this quality. What would happen by the late 1950s and early 1960s, however, is that this quality of dual protest would become common among a broad range of leftists, all claiming to be revolutionary, so subjectively revolutionary, but distancing themselves from official communism. This was the phenomenon of the New Left. Now, the rise of the New Left would prove a turning point for Trotskyism in complicated ways, ways that Trotskyism, as formulated by Trotsky in a pre-New Left era, would have difficulty fully thinking through. In general, the extent to which the left as a whole would change after 1960 or so is something that still is not adequately registered by Trotskyists. The Platypus assertion, for example, that what is most interesting about the Spartacist League is its resistance to the New Left, and that the most depressing thing about its senescence is the extent to which it reverts to New Leftism, is not only a statement that the Sparts would disagree with, one would expect them to disagree with it, it's one that I suspect most of them would find baffling in the extreme. They just wouldn't understand the statement. But similar assertions about, say, Postone and the New Left would be met with equal bafflement by their targets. People would not know what we meant by them. Part of the problem here is terminological. By speaking of the New Left, one is speaking not just about a specific movement or series of movement, but a series of cultural shifts in the way the left operated and thought of itself. In a particular moment, this could be seen as generational. Nowadays, to talk of people in their 70s as youths would, of course, be absurd, and we can see that what was going on from the late 1950s to the late 1970s was actually an epochal shift. Paradoxically, it is easier to address this problem of sensibility by quoting someone who stands on the opposite pole of Platypus in recognition of it, i.e. as someone who recognized what Platypus recognizes better than the Sparks could because of the limitations of their orthodoxy, but who thought the shift was good. So here's Mary Bookchin in Listen, Marxist. Our concern here is with those honest revolutionaries who have turned to Marxism, Leninism, or Trotskyism because they earnestly seek a coherent social outlook and an effective strategy of revolution. We are also concerned with those who are awed by the theoretical repertory of Marxist ideology and are disposed to flirt with it in the absence of more systematic alternatives. To these people, we address ourselves as brothers and sisters and ask for a serious discussion and a comprehensive reevaluation. We believe that Marxism has ceased to be applicable to our time, not because it is too visionary or revolutionary, but because it is not visionary or revolutionary enough. We believe that it was born of an era of scarcity and presented a brilliant critique of that era, specifically of industrial capitalism, and that a new era is in birth, which Marxism does not adequately encompass, and whose outlines it only partially and one-sidedly anticipated. We argue that the problem is not to abandon Marxism or to annul it, but to transcend it dialectically, just as Marx transcended Hegelian philosophy, Ricardian economics, and Blanquist tactics and modes of social organization. We shall argue that in a more advanced stage of capitalism than Marx dealt with a century ago, and in a more advanced stage of technological development than Marx could have clearly anticipated, a new critique is necessary, which in turn yields new modes of struggle, of organization, of propaganda, and of lifestyle. Now, first of all, note the distinction Bookchin makes between Marxism, Leninism, or Trotskyism. This or would obviously be ridiculous to a Trotskyist who insists that Trotskyism was Leninism which in turn was Marxism, and that anyone who really wanted to be a Marxist had to be a Leninist, and if one really wanted to be a Leninist, one had to be a Trotskyist. Bookchin, an ex-Trotskyist, undoubtedly knew all this, and his choice of words was not accidental. The point Bookchin is making is that all these terms are now irrelevant. And to make this even clearer, he then, speaking of those who insist on the continuing validity of Marxism, says, "We are asked, in short, to return to the past, to diminish instead of grow, to force the throbbing reality of our times with its hopes and promises into the deadening preconceptions of an outlived age. We are asked to operate with principles that have transcended not only theoretically, but by the very development of society itself. History has not stood still since Marx, Engels, Lenin, and Trotsky died, nor has it followed the simplistic direction which was charted out by thinkers, however brilliant, whose minds were still rooted in the 19th century or in the opening years of the 20th. We have seen capitalism itself perform many of the tasks, including the development of technology of abundance, which were regarded as socialist. We have seen it nationalize property, merging the economy with the state wherever necessary. We've seen the working class neutralized as the agent of revolutionary change, albeit still struggling within a bourgeois framework for more wages, shorter hours, and fringe benefits. The class struggle in the classical sense has not disappeared. It has suffered a more deadening fate by being co-opted into capitalism. The revolutionary struggle within the advanced capitalist countries has shifted to an historically new terrain. It has become a struggle between a generation of youth that has known no chronic economic crisis and the culture, values, and institutions of an older conservative generation whose perspective on life has been shaped by scarcity, guilt, renunciation, the work ethic, and the pursuit of material security." In other words, sex was invented in 1963. Ironically, I think it is now Bookchin's perspective that seems absurdly dated. So he brings in the character of an 18-year-old in 1937 who he says is now 50. Well, that 50-year-old, if he or she is still alive, is now 93. In retrospect, the world of that old person's middle age is, I think, further from our reality than that person's adolescence is. Indeed, that, I think, that realization, I think, is what makes Platypus appealing to most of you, and in a sense, the Trotsky and the Frankfurt School have much more to say about the present than almost anything later could. We are premised on the assumption that there's hardly been a new idea on the left since 1940, and that at best we can distinguish ourselves by the depth of our reflection on the unrealized potential of old ideas. The greatest resistance to this idea of how barren the left has been for a long time comes from the fact that the people whose idea of the left is now hegemonic are those who were 18 in 1969, not 18 in 1937. Instead of saying, as Bookchin does, "We are asked, in short, to return to the past, to diminish instead of grow, to force the throbbing reality of our times with its hopes and promises into the deadening preconceptions of an outlived age," Platypus can say, "We are forced, in short, to return to the past, to grow instead of to diminish, to force the pallid pseudo-reality of our times with its despair and pseudo-activism into a painful but hopefully awakening contrast with the once rational hopes of a more vibrant age." Bookchin states, "History has not stood still since Marx, Engels, Lenin, and Trotsky died," and this seems like an obvious truism. It is to the credit of Platypus that it questions this obvious truism. However, something an orthodox Marxist, including a Trotsky, would not do. In a very real sense, Platypus believes that the only way history has not stood still is that it has moved backwards. If this process continues, then history, in the sense Marxism means it, will completely cease to exist, and both Marxism and the object of its critique will vanish unredeemed, a remarkable accident on a perhaps unremarkable planet. For to Platypus, what makes it possible for history to, quote, go forward, unquote, is the existence of the left. Only in a purely negative sense do we have any advantage over Marx, Engels, Lenin, and Trotsky. We can understand the significance of their absence more. Here, too, one might say something about being on the left. To be on the left is not the opposite of being on the right. The central assumption of the right is rather that the left does not actually exist at all. The right sees the entire worldview of the left as either a cynical hoax, you know, the Bolsheviks were just power mad, or a form of helpless stupidity. So all leftists are either con artists or dupes. In this respect, the awareness that the left is dead might in and of itself, even be true, be a form of right-wing consciousness. So that's a problem for Platypus to think about that. Now, a central characteristic of much of the new left was anti-communism. Although this was directed primarily at anti-communist Cold War social democrats and liberals, and subjectively represented a move to the left, it also effectively negated the difference between Trotskyism and Stalinism. For anti-anti-communism in practice amounted to anti-anti-Stalinism. The effect of this anti-anti-communism would be first to disarm the new left vis-a-vis apparently new forms of Stalinism, particularly Maoism, and then later, as a reaction against this, to lead it into a mindless anti-Stalinism in which even the most reactionary forces could be imagined as liberating as long as they were fighting Stalinists, you know, like in Afghanistan. One might say that the new left misrecognized its own time and the relationship of the 60s to the 30s. The new left could not overcome the debates of the 30s by ignoring them, and in the end, the new left capitulated to the logic of both Stalinism, particularly Maoism, and later social democracy. In no way, however, does the new left represent intellectual progress. Indeed, the new left is ultimately the manifestation of what Chris rightly called the obscurity of the mid-20th century. It surrendered easily to an impressionistic reading of its moment and garbled the earlier history of the 20th century. Bookchin was quite right that all the old crap, he meant Marxism, was returning, but he misdiagnosed the problem. It was not intellectual conservatism that brought Marxism back, but the unresolved symptom that brought back an eclectic Marxism that combined flashes of insight with terrible muddle-headedness. The great tragedy of the 60s left is that it could not find its way back to Trotskyism. Not so much the idea of Trotsky, the intransigent revolutionary, but rather Trotsky as a critic of the left from within. It thought falsely that the old problems were gone and that Trotskyism belonged to the old. We, of course, have a different problem. We are the inheritor of the 60s misrecognition of themselves, which means that we are tasked with both untangling ourselves from the legacy of the 60s and seeing how the 60s misunderstood the 30s. Even the path to Trotskyism that was still available in the 1960s is no longer available to us. The interest of the sparse is that, to us, is that more than anyone else, they seem to recognize this at that time. The problem is that they did not perhaps recognize the extent to which they, too, were products of their moment. That is to say, neo-Orthodox, not Orthodox. Now, mentioning the problem of the 60s seems paradoxical vis-a-vis Trotskyism, for it was just at this time, in the early to late 60s and early 70s, that Trotskyism underwent a boom. In many countries, including major ones such as Germany, Trotskyism is almost entirely a post-1968 phenomenon, with little or no connection to any previous Trotskyism. There are a lot of countries for which that's the case, probably most countries in the world. Trotskyism took off during this period, however, by adapting itself to the zeitgeist. So a young person encountering the ISO today thus encounters a nominal Trotsky and Trotskyism through several removes. First of all, Cliff was not Trotsky. Secondly, the international socialist tradition of the 60s and 70s was less interesting as a symptom than Cliff when he was formulating his theory of state capitalism at the height of the Cold War. Finally, the Stalinophobia of the international socialists, SWP, ISO, etc., during the Cold War represented a vastly better phenomenon than the pro-Islamist apologias of the present. To explain what has happened here is complex, however. The storylines are tangled, and those who might tell them have no clear interest in doing so. So the problem here cannot here be reduced simply to degeneration. On the contrary, a narrative of degeneration presupposes that there is always a correct revolutionary line which revolutionary organizations tell them to fall away from, only due to alien class pressure. My sense, by contrast, is that the failures of the left are due above all to the inadequacy of its ideas and its failure of nerve. It is a cliche of the radical left, but especially of Trotskyism, it's a problem with Trotskyism, that one is always capable of choosing to be revolutionary, to be on the left side of history. That this choice is possible is, however, simply assumed. But one of the lessons of the disintegration of Trotskyism in mid-century is that which way is left is not always clear, and this may be because the category of left does not always exist. It didn't, after all, for most of human history. Now, to me, above all, a single question remains predominant in this overview of Trotskyism. Was Trotsky right about Stalinism? Was it Thermidor? I've always been troubled by this metaphor. To begin with, the real Thermidor, the Thermidor of July 27, 28, 1794, whose 218th anniversary is today, well, it's actually the anniversary of the execution of Robespierre, the ninth Thermidor would have been yesterday. So the real Thermidor has always seemed to me inevitable. I cannot see what sort of policy would have avoided it. You know, a shift by the Jacobins to the left towards an incipient socialism. I mean, I just don't see a way that Thermidor wouldn't have happened. But furthermore, the Jacobins were defeated by their political opponents, where Stalinism seemed to grow within the heart of the Revolutionary Party. So Robespierre went to the guillotine, Lenin was embalmed. This is not a minor difference. It was precisely the claim of Stalinism's continuity with Bolshevism that has wreaked such havoc. But if Stalinism was not Thermidor, and I find it hard to understand, for example, say Castro and Mao as Thermidor, then what was it? The alternative answers given in the mid-20th century that took for granted the permanence of Stalinism, i.e. bureaucratic collectivism and state capitalism, no longer hold water after 1989-1991. And even leaving aside the complicated problem of how one understands China today, the future of the world, barring the dramatic return of Marxism, seems clearly to belong to the normal capitalism that Marx analyzed in the 19th century, not some new form of class society, as many thought in the mid-20th century. Trotsky's views in the 30s on the essential instability of Stalinism have in the long run been empirically confirmed. But like 1917 itself, Stalinism retains a deeply mysterious element. Even if one feels that one has a handle on the victory of Stalinism in certain countries, the enduring appeal of multiple forms of Stalinism to intellectuals in advanced capitalist countries for much of the 20th century remains mysterious. I mean, why not social democracy, or why not Trotskyism? That there is a satisfactory material explanation to these problems seems to me doubtful. Perhaps the central weakness of classical Marxism has been that while being does indeed determine consciousness, the range of possible ideas compatible with any given social form is greater than might have been anticipated. As such, political ideas in particular are as much a legacy of all political ideas as they are a response to present social reality. Obviously, they have to conform to the social reality in some sense. Classical Marxism, which includes Trotskyism, was, it appears, much too optimistic with regard to the tendency of political ideas to assimilate themselves to reality eventually. There is not much that can be said about this excessive generosity towards the intelligence and good sense of the human species. We are stuck with humanity as we find it. Also, for many decades at the end of the 19th century and into the 20th, this optimism seemed rationally grounded. And it may still be in the long run. But even if Stalinism completely disappears, the trauma of Stalinism is likely to persist. Maybe capitalism is not worth abolishing if it means the gulag. Maybe instead we should try to change the world without taking power. The Trotskyist tradition, though, still seems to me the most serious Marxist attempt to preserve Marxism, the most serious attempt to preserve Marxism in the face of the trauma of Stalinism. I'm coming to an end. So, recently, I had a dream that I was on the beach, and I met a woman who told me that her boyfriend was French and that he'd been in the Paris Commune. She pointed him out, and at a distance, I saw a man sitting on a beach towel whom I thought might have been in Paris during May of 1968. He actually looked like Alain Badiou, but certainly not the Paris Commune. She insisted, however, that he was actually about 158 years old and that I should go over and talk to him. Unfortunately, my friends called me away at just that moment and I had to leave the beach. Then I woke up. So I was thinking about this dream and a strange fantasy took over. I imagined that a character, not as in the Bookchin essay, a young person born in 1937, born in 1919, say living to be a middle-aged person in 1969, or even an old one in 2012, but rather a character, undying leftist. If any of you have ever seen the movie The Man from Earth, it's about this caveman from the Paleolithic who just keeps on living and doesn't age. Came about 5 years ago. Anyway, so I imagine this character, and say, born in 1778, the year of the death of Rousseau and Voltaire, who magically keeps on living until the present, but he doesn't age beyond his mid-20s. So an 11-year-old at the time of the Revolution, he's 16 at the time of Thermidor. Then he joins Babeuf in the Conspiracy of Equals as an adolescent after Thermidor. He lives persecuted under the Directory. He lives under Napoleon. Despite all this, he remains committed to the vision of the just society. He's still a Jacobin, a radical Democrat, but slowly the complexity of the task becomes more apparent to him as the decades roll on. Still a man of the people, a worker, he perhaps takes part in the strikes of the 30s and visits England, where he gets to know the Chartists. He's also attracted to early utopian socialists like Fourier and Saint-Simon. Still young in appearance, remember, he does not age. In Paris, he gets to know a young German exile, Karl Marx, in the 40s, who seems to bring a particularly profound and philosophical insight into the problems of modern society. He begins to read Hegel and understands that amid much that still remains obscure to him, that here was a thinker who grappled with the philosophical significance of history. At 70, but still unaging and in appearance much younger, he takes part in the Revolution of 1848. And is appropriately disgusted by the accession of Louis Napoleon, not having been all that keen on his uncle either. In his army, he had nevertheless fought decades earlier. Then, after the tragic experience of the Commune, by now 100 or so, he relocates to Germany, where he becomes a social democrat. At first persecuted, but later legal, he watches the social democrats grow, and now his youthful Jacobinism seems to have found a new home. But purged of its bloody moralism, the socialist future of mankind is now assured by science. Good citizen of the 19th century is very pleased by this. Still, a certain malaise is felt around the edges. The party feels, well, a trifle bourgeois and unrevolutionary now and then. Nevertheless, the challenge of the revisionist seems beaten back. But by contrast, the Russian movement is a different story. Still only in his late 120s, our hero witnesses the Petersburg Soviet and meets his charismatic leader, Bronstein, a.k.a. Trotsky. Then the catastrophe of World War I, and total despair. Has European civilization come so far only to be engulfed in barbarism? But then comes 1917, and once again there is hope. But after a few years of great optimism, once again conservatism triumphs and order reigns. Then the storm clouds of Stalinism and fascism appear. For a while, Spain seems to hold up the torch of revolutionary hope, but that too is drowned in fascist victory. Once again, the question of revolution in the modern world seems raised, but the answers are fragmentary and inconclusive. Surviving on into the post-war world, our hero witnesses the Cold War and the earlier struggles of Trotskyists to understand it. Disillusioned with Trotskyism, perhaps he moves on to various new left-influenced currents, perhaps anarchism. Perhaps later, disillusioned by the new left, he follows the sparks. He's sympathetic to their critical spirit, but maintains a distance, aware that the living experience of the Trotskyism he knew under Trotsky and the desire to maintain the idea of Trotskyism, there is a difference. Finally, perhaps in his early 230s, he comes around to some Platypus events and asks himself, what was it all about? So much has happened, and yet, despite the fantastic achievements of science and technology, and the struggles of so many, humanity remains unfree and miserable. This is fantasy, science fiction fantasy, of course. In reality, the history of the left stretches not over one biologically impossible lifetime, but rather three possible ones stuck end to end. By the way, consider, for example, the character of George Ledebour, who fought in the Franco-Prussian War, started out as a bourgeois liberal, joined the Social Democrats, opposed World War I, became a founder of the Independent Social Democratic Party, survived fascism, and lived until the age of 97, dying in 1947, his last political act being to call for support of the Social Democrats and Communists in the Socialist Unity Party that would become the governing party of the German Democratic Republic. So, one very long life. Not quite the 230 years, but anyway, it's my fantasy. So in telling the story of Trotskyism in this eccentric and wildly partial, in both senses, fashion, I've been acutely aware that Trotskyism has already lasted a lifetime. Indeed, more time has elapsed since Trotsky's death than Trotsky lived. But this long life of Trotskyism is clearly a problem, but the nature of the problem remains obscure. I mean, I want to say one thing about this notion, that the idea that the left and that the struggle for human freedom is only three lifetimes old shows how new the idea of freedom is in human history. So this long life of Trotskyism is clearly a problem. Trotskyism has started out as the ideology of permanent revolution, and it has become the ideology of revolution permanently deferred. This has given it a constantly renewable source of energy, but it has made it into a strange object. I do not imagine that Platypus could live so long as Trotskyism has. On the contrary, unlike Trotskyism, Platypus remains acutely aware of our mortality as a political tradition. We are young now, but we will age, and I don't mean personally, I mean organizationally and intellectually. Unlike Trotskyism, we cannot freeze our hopes into perpetuity with the revolution constantly deferred by fresh betrayals. Platypus belongs precisely to our moment in a way that Trotskyism does not. This is perhaps our justification. Uniquely, on what remains of the left, we belong to the present. Let us make use of it. Okay. Questions?
Go ahead, Russ. Nothing.
Oh, yet. Okay. So the periodization of 1953 to 1963, I think in the first lecture I mentioned this, is interesting to me because it's punctuated on either end by, first of all, the death of Stalin. Then sort of midway through, there's de-Stalinization, the secret speech, and so on.
Richard, don't move this.
And... then in 1963, after the Cuban Missile Crisis, there's Khrushchev is deposed, basically rendered completely powerless. Does 1963 as the sort of end of Trotskyism as a sort of vital left movement reflect simply its inadequacy to deal with the problem of the rise of the new left? Or does it also somehow mirror the sort of death of Stalinism under Stalin and its sort of ambiguous continuation under Khrushchev and then the sort of later recrudescence of old Stalinism under Brezhnev?
I don't think that the later Stalinism had much effect on Trotskyism. I think Trotskyism is reacting to its natural habitat of the advanced capitalist world and is reacting to changes in the character of the left in the post-war world. I mean... it's a joke, sex began in 1963, but it's the sensibility of a new generation and new ways of thinking about politics. As long as your problems on the left are a monolithic Stalinism or a reformist social democracy, Trotskyism could easily stake out a clear position. When Trotskyism is competing with Maoism or nowadays with anarchism or with all sorts of other ideologies, and Trotskyism itself seems more and more splintered, what it meant to be a Trotskyist shift, and the whole character of the left shift. So the left becomes less a creature of parties and more of movements. I mean, in the early 20th century, the left is assumed to be the struggle of political parties. I mean, you increasingly have a left that's not focused around political parties, that people don't see a need to belong to any political party. They're part of a movement. And you're part of the anti-war movement. In the United States, the anti-war movement, the main liberal was led by the SWP, right? A nominal Trotskyist party, in which, the Spartans say is betrayal of Trotskyism, which is true. But the more significant thing is that the mass of people who went through the anti-war movement were totally unaffected by the fact that the organizational strings of these demonstrations were pulled by a Trotskyist party instead of a communist party or... I mean, the political effect was the same. It was irrelevant. So it's the gradual shift of the Trotskyist critique into a seeming irrelevance. I mean, you have a lot of people then who are kind of sympathetic to Trotskyism, but they don't see a need to be Trotskyists. It's sort of like, well, Trotsky had some good ideas, right? So it's much easier in the earlier period, actually, where things were more polarized.
Just briefly to follow up on that, I would agree that Trotskyism's native habitat was the advanced capitalist countries to which it was exiled, but didn't the left in those countries and to a certain extent mirror developments in the Soviet Union, such as the Thaw and...
I mean, it mirrored them to a certain extent in that if you have, like, if Stalinism doesn't seem like a totalitarian monolith, I mean, that obviously has effects. And also the biggest effect was that the breakup of the central discipline of the Soviet Union over Western communist parties meant that Western communism was itself more open to diverging tendencies and interpretations. So you didn't have the same sense you did in 1950 of there's one official communist movement, and then there are the Trotskyists on the margin saying, no, that's the betrayal.
Mm-hmm. I have a question. There's one here. I'll give mine and then go to the online. About, you use the category unconscious Stalinism when describing your friend who didn't care about Russia because they were white people who lived in gray houses. And I thought that was like indicative because I think actually that category bears a lot of weight in your approach in general to both what you think of as sort of the contemporary obstacles towards reforming left ideas as well as left politics. And your own approach, or what you think, you know, how what you think Platypus's approach ought to be to dealing with those problems, right? That you think the sort of legacy of Stalinism and your critique of Bookchin is that exactly like we're not at the point where one can say like, okay, 20th century, terrible, let's have done with it, let's think of something new and not accept substitute satisfactions, whatever they may be, anarchism, etc., but that the reason people are willing to accept substitute satisfactions, anarchism or constant protest, is the persistence of unconscious Stalinism.
Bookchin is like honest. Like his criticism is not just of Stalinism or Leninism or Trotskyism. His criticism is of Marxism per se. So Bookchin is making a criticism of Marxism, saying Marxism is outdated. I think that particular moment where we feel, oh, we live in this society of great abundance and Marxism is this archaic like ideology of the late 19th, early 20th century. I think that moment in a way has passed. So I don't think we have the sort of sense of the throbbing possibilities of the present. And in fact, I think part of what makes Marxism to some extent appealing in a very pallid, confused form is that sense that we have returned. We've gone backwards. I don't think that's the Bookchin problem.
David Harvey is a like nice little thing for all my problems with him. You know, he's been teaching Capital since the 70s, and he has like a reflection on this. He's like, when I taught Capital in 1970, I used to have to do all this like backtracking. Okay, but what about the state? What about this? What about that? Now, you know, you just open up the New York Times, and it's like Capital seems.
Yeah.
You know.
Right. I think that the legacy of like unconscious Stalinism comes in. Like, I mean, if you look at, I bring up Badiou and Žižek. I mean, both Badiou and Žižek are profoundly Stalinist-influenced figures. I think that there are all sorts of ways in which Stalinism or an equation of Stalinism with Leninism and the Bolshevik Revolution, so either in fear or in negation, that it distorts the history of the left. That I don't think that the Trotskyist critique of Stalinism has gone very deep. I think that there's a sense that Trotsky opposed Stalin, but I think that there is a tendency to, you know, do the Bookchin maneuver, Marxism, Leninism, Trotskyism, whatever, that it's the old left. And I mean, I think that the point I was making about the problem of the new left, that our problem, is that it's the way the left of the 60s and 70s didn't understand, quote, the old left, meaning the left of the 20s and 30s. I use the 30s and 60s, but it's really also the problem of, as Chris very accurately pointed out, of the 20s and the 70s. The way it didn't digest those experiences, and we're stuck with the absence of that digestion of experience. And I mean, in the 60s, a return to Trotskyism would have meant something very different from what it could mean now. I mean, the possibilities would have been much different.
Okay, so let me do, there are a couple questions here, and then Lisa will come to you. So this is from someone named Spartapus, who I don't know who that is. But anyways, the question is, Richard, what would you say are the most important differences between Chris and Chris Catrone and yourself in regards to the content of this course?
Oh, I was glad someone asked me that question. So I think that there are two tendencies on which we tend to differ slightly. One difference has to do with the relationship of Trotsky and Lenin. And it's not an absolute difference. I think that Chris tends to feel that Lenin as a figure is more separable from Trotsky than I do. So I think that the problem of Leninism, I tend to subsume the problem of Leninism into the problem of Trotskyism. Chris does not. I think that's one important theoretical difference. I don't know that leads to any political difference, but it is a different way of thinking. I think also that I tend to be more willing, and this goes back to the question about the Mandelite or my misdiagnosed sympathy for Mandelism, I tend to be more willing to separate the analytical from the political question. And I think that also goes with a tendency to perhaps emphasize the empirical aspect of Marxism more than the philosophical.
It's your petty bourgeois intellectual tendencies.
Yeah, my
renegadism.
Empiricism. And, so another question from here.
I was hoping at least to be middle.
Chris actually just said empiricists and renegades. So Chris Catrone also did have a question. Nonlinear notion of regression, not merely nonlinear notion of historical progress. In other words, the issue of return needs to be nonlinear.
Yes, I agree. I mean, I think that point is correct, that the notion of a return is not the same. That, I mean, I think Chris is spot on that. I mean, I think that's implicit in everything Platypus does, that you can't just return to Marx or return to Lenin or return to Trotsky in the same way in a different historical period.
Marx made that same point. Can't return to 1789 and 1848.
I mean, even Platypus within its own short period, I think the meaning of Platypus has slightly shifted in subtle ways that we're not fully aware of. And I'm sure it will in 10 years. And if Platypus is around in 10 years, we will have a very different sense of what Platypus is about and what the meaning of these things are.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's, my question actually goes into this because last week, which I was listening to your lecture while driving, but you talked about how no one had been able to repeat 1917. And that in some ways, that's the mark of how, you know, the most progress that humanity has been able to make. I mean, I took it this way, at least. I might be summarizing things that you said. But basically, I mean, it does seem that since 1917, I mean, I'm thinking about this in relation to how you put the three lifetimes together, and so that's how the left is. But yet, since 1917, the left, in a way, would only be that which can digest and assimilate, and in some ways repeat with a difference, 1917. So it would have to be, in some ways, a repetition, right? But just in this current context, not a repetition as in, oh, we're going to put the Gopher program, Marxist, you know, to get the Gopher program into, you know, come up with something.
A repetition in the sense of a repetition of the positive accomplishment without the negative. I mean, obviously you don't want to replay the entire tragic history of the world endlessly.
Yeah.
I mean, but the fact that 1917 has not been repeated, which is clear within Platypus, is not generally understood to be the case. I mean, asserting that is already, to a large extent, asserting the centrality of Trotskyism.
Yeah.
Because you know, Maoists would say, well, what do you mean 1917? There was 1949 in China. People would say, well, what about Cuba? Right? So you're already saying, well, no, China and Cuba are a different story. What happened in Eastern Europe after World War II was a different story.
Yeah.
And you have to explain why that is, because those societies bear a fundamental resemblance to what seemed to emerge in the Soviet Union.
But they were not a workers' revolution, essentially, or in some way.
Right, but the difference lies not in the society that emerged.
Right.
The difference lies in the political character of the revolution.
Yes.
And here, by the way, I'm completely in agreement with Chris. I mean, that's where Lenin is fundamentally a figure of a completely different order from a Fidel Castro or a Mao.
Yeah.
Why?
Explain that again. I agree with that. But
internal political debates.
Because I think that, I mean, it comes back to a kind of circular point. I mean, because I think that Lenin just represents a figure of an obviously higher order, and I think that the significance of the Bolshevik Revolution just as a break from capitalism represents a more fundamental phenomenon that to which all the other breaks were indebted. In other words, I think if there hadn't been a Bolshevik Revolution, which is due to the Bolsheviks and above all Lenin, that there wouldn't have been any subsequent overturns of capitalism. I mean, Chris doesn't like the term non-capitalist or whatever, but you wouldn't have had any other non-capitalist states unless there was some other leader of the stature of Lenin, unless there was something like the Bolshevik Revolution.
Right.
So I think that you see that particularly with the disappearance of the Soviet Union. I mean, I think that the disappearance of the Soviet Union, I think, has clearly closed the possibility of even those types of, don't like to call them revolutions, but Stalinist overturns of capitalism that were possible during the Cold War, that are no longer possible.
Yeah. So as a follow-up question then, I mean, what I'm taking to be, in some ways, your emphasis on Trotsky is precisely that he was the only Second International Radical who survived 1917 and carried on that legacy, and that some aspects of Trotskyism are important precisely for that reason, that even though they embody something of, I mean, if there's any possibility, they embody, like, I mean, you just said about
what I think Trotskyism has two aspects. One is it embodies a memory of an earlier left. Mm-hmm. Like, even in its most distorted sectarian form, unfortunately, it seems sectarian to embody that memory, but it does. The other thing that it does, and this is, again, my emphasis on the problem of Stalinism, that I think that for all the flaws that I feel, the incompleteness of Trotsky's response to Stalinism, that is not to me a fully satisfactory response. The problem of thinking about Stalinism as Thermidor, it still seems to me the best response that Marxism has produced in the 20th century. Right? And that's why, for example, I don't think that other Marxist traditions that have other insights, like in that sense, the Frankfurt School doesn't have a theory of Stalinism. It wasn't something that the Frankfurt School really formulated or that can be used the way Trotsky's understanding of Stalinism. And I don't see any other theory of Stalinism within a Marxist framework that seems to me anywhere nearly as plausible as Trotsky's understanding. Despite the fact that on many fundamental points, particularly timing, Trotsky was wrong, and that the central metaphor that he brings up, the metaphor of Thermidor, is deeply problematic. But again, I don't have anything better to suggest. And the people who thought they had better ideas, I think were wrong, more wrong than Trotsky. And I think that, again, that's been empirically confirmed. So Stalinism wasn't something, some new stable form of class domination.
Right.
But it's not even that. Like, it's not just the question of state capitalism. I mean, the bureaucratic collectivist argument would be that the bureaucracy is a new type of ruling class. Well, I don't think that that holds water. I think you look at the history of the last 25 years. The behavior of the bureaucracy was not that of a ruling class. It liquidated itself as a class. Okay? It liquidated itself as a class in order to become, a large part of it, capitalist in an ordinary sense. However you understand China poses other theoretical problems to a classical Trotskyist analysis, the future of China doesn't seem to be some kind of state capitalism in the sense in which people like Cliff were talking about it. It seems probably a very ordinary capitalism. So what you're talking about is capitalism, unmodified. That's what triumphed. And whatever Stalinism was, thinking of it as this incomplete, unstable phenomenon that's the result of an incomplete political revolution in a backward country, still makes more sense from a Marxist perspective than any of the other theories that have been offered.
Thank you.
So Chris had a follow-up point on Thermidor, Chris Catron. Thermidor assumes the potential of socialism continuing despite political reaction, just as bourgeois society continued despite the Napoleonic Empire, where we would say that Stalinism undermined socialism profoundly rather than transmitting it in obscured form. Which again goes to the non-symmetry of socialist revolution versus capitalist revolution in 1789.
Well, yes. Although, I mean, the two problems with that. I mean, one is the sense in which Stalinism undermined socialism is that it undermined the idea of socialism. I mean, the problem is with that judgment is that in certain ways, the collapse of Stalinism also undermined socialism, very obvious ways. So that to defend the idea of a planned economy is much harder now than it would have been in the mid-20th century, because people say, look, it's a failure or it's totalitarian. So in that sense, I think one has to avoid formulations that Stalinism was completely reactionary. I think in that sense that the sort of tension in Trotsky's thought has validity. And I'm more sympathetic to that as time has passed since 1989, that the earlier up through 1991, I would have been more sympathetic to Stalinism's completely reactionary character, and now I see it as like a very ambiguous problem. I mean, one of the paradoxes of post-war social democracy, despite the hostility of social democracy and Stalinism, is that the success of social democracy in Western Europe was largely predicated on the victory of Stalinism in Eastern Europe.
But I have a question, and this goes back to the kind of mission of Platypus and the relation of, you know, so, I mean, it was brought up, I think Ross mentioned that, you know, Marx seeing new tasks that are being created in the mid-19th century. You're saying that Marx looked at the empirical world around him, right? So if we, in some sense, live on, like, the wreckage of the broad history of the left and of all the left institutions created, started in the 19th century, like Marx, to some degree, was standing on, like, the wreckage of the French Revolution, the tradition of bourgeois radicalism. Why is it? It would seem that the analogous thing to do would be exactly to sort of ask the question about, well, what is the nature of our period? Like, what is our empirical reality? Rather than dig deep into the wreckage. Why are we digging deep into the wreckage?
Well, I think that the idea of standing on top of the wreckage is the problem. The problem is we're not standing on top of the wreckage. The wreckage is on top of us and has buried us. So that's the number one problem. That's how we're in a different position. We're actually trying to dig our way out of the wreckage, not dig our way into the wreckage. Mm. And, I mean, empirically, again, I don't think that the problem of Marxism is to analyze the economic character of the world. I don't think that that's where Marxism is most challenged. The difficulty of Marxism is to address the political aspects of the 20th century. I mean, the difficulty for Trotskyism is to explain its own impotence. I mean, it's not that more than anything else.
Yeah, I was wondering, especially with Bookchin's objection and critique of Marxism as a whole,
I just chose that as a symptom. I mean, but
as a symptom,
it's a well-written symptom of an attitude.
Yeah, and I think it presents interesting points, and especially, like, you know, towards a failure of post-Trotsky Trotskyism to conceptualize itself in its own time. Especially, I mean, while it might have offered a very, perhaps the most plausible explanation of the East in terms of the whole Cold War dichotomy, the communist Stalinist world, what were the, I mean, and I understand this goes beyond 63, but what would you say are the sort of successes and failures of post 63 Trotskyism to either conceive of the semi-stable world of Keynesian Fordism, where, I mean, there wasn't really that much of a crisis and until like the 70s, and then subsequently like the seemingly never-ending crisis of neoliberalism. I know that late Capital by Ernest Mandel is often held up as...
Yeah, I mean, I think that Ernest Mandel's career as an economist is symptomatic in a good sense of the seriousness with which Trotskyists could still take Marxist economics and try to make it relevant. And of people whom we would admire, not necessarily Trotskyists, but people like Moshe Mapover came from a kind of semi-Trotskyist Israeli background. Someone like Kleiman from News and Letters comes from, it's not a Trotskyist exactly, but it's kind of an ex-Trotskyist background. So, I mean, I think that's where you get most of the serious Marxist economics. I mean, I don't think Bookchin's predictions and Bookchin's view of his historical moment, I think, has been refuted by the last 40 years.
Yes. So. Stability and abundance, no crisis.
Well, I mean, I don't think abundance has been empirically refuted. It's just that, like, you know, somehow...
Well, accessibility to the abundance.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, that's what we're talking about. I mean, that the capitalist economy could produce, like, incredible amounts of wealth is not the issue of Marxism. It's the question of, like, whether human beings in general would be free to enjoy that, and whether
it builds palaces but forces workers in the hovels.
Yeah, so I don't think that really needs to be. Are there more questions?
We've been disconnected, unfortunately. New School's internet seems to be down. So for now, we're amongst ourselves.
Wait, when did?
Just 3 minutes ago.
Okay. Do you want to take a break?
Kristen.
Okay, then I'm going to stop the recording. Should we?
I guess so.
I guess the gods of the internet have spoken. Here, one sec. I might be able to get this. One sec.
This is not to be. No longer.
Yeah, I don't know why. Okay, so I guess we're going to end here. Goodbye, gods of the internet. Thank you, Richard, and we'll continue the discussion after a break.